last name again? That's always an important question I have to ask people.
Yeah, good question. Aubury.
Aubury.
A lot of people get it wrong. It's an old French name, so I don't expect people to get it.
No, because it's, every time I interview someone, even if I always ask them how they pronounce it, because it's so easy, because there's some people, it's like, oh, hang on, that's a incorrect pronunciation. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, when I was at school, most people got it wrong, and I ended up answering to most things. Aubury was a common one.
Yeah.
You know, Albury, variations. So, yeah, I'll answer to most variations.
Did you ever get called Matthew or just Matt?
Only when I was in trouble, yeah.
Matthew?
Matthew, yes. So when if anyone says Matthew, then my ears prick. What have I done?
Yep. Matthew Aubury?
Yes, put that down.
Yeah. Well, having a surname like Ferrugia, I've always thought, I've got to respect people's surnames because my name is perpetually mispronounced.
There you go. So you know it.
And even other people tell me that I pronounce my name incorrectly all the time. They go, oh, no, it should be Ferrugia. And I was like, yeah, I know, but it's not Italian. I say it.
Derived from Italian.
It's from Malta. My dad is from Malta. And then it's like you don't tell me how to say my name.
Yeah, that's funny. People correcting you with their own name. I mean, that's kind of rude.
Oh, it's so funny. Or once I went to a school where they taught Italian, and when they saw my surname, they go, oh, you must speak Italian. You must be fluent in Italian. I'm like, well, no. And it doesn't say that on my CV either. You know, like,
that's it.
It's an assumption.
Yeah.
It's like looking
totally get that.
It's like when someone looks at an Asian person and just assumes that they must be fluent in Chinese.
That's what it must be a bit like. My name is French, but my middle name was even more French, which I actually dropped partly because it was so French, people would, for the same thing, would think I was French. And for many years, I couldn't even spell it. It was such a difficult name. Le Boutier is my middle name. I just dropped it because I didn't want that French connection.
You don't want the French connection?
Which sounds bad, I guess. But as a kid growing up in England, it wasn't something that was helping me.
Yeah, right.
It was being Johnny Foreigner by sounding French.
The English have never been huge fans of the French.
Well, there's history. Let's just say that.
There is a lot of history.
So we're all together now, but for a long time, you know, it was a bit back and forth, and
but anyway,
it didn't do me any favours, so I dropped the middle.
Where are you from specifically?
So from the north of England, Yorkshire, which is cold and wet. The Vikings were up there, the Romans were up there. It's got a lot of history, and it's beautiful, but yeah, it's cold and wet. So one reason I moved to Australia.
Yeah, you wouldn't be the first. So you came here as an adult?
Or? Yeah, as a young adult, as a graduate in my very early 20s. One-way ticket in the days when you could just buy a one-way ticket.
Yeah.
Got on a plane and came on over. And here I am.
And then
20-something years later.
Amazing. But then you've, tell us. So obviously, welcome to the Trail Runners Experience.
Thank you.
You like how seamlessly we started this?
I like that. You just segued straight in there without much of a segue.
That's how we do it. You know, when you blokes like Joe Rogan could learn a thing or two. No, just
totally.
We're on the Trail Runners Experience because you are a runner, and we've got lots of exciting things I want to ask you about. But yeah, we'll go right back and learn a little bit about Matt Albury. Oh, I said it wrong, didn't I? Albury.
Well, we did. Yeah,
I know. Don't worry, I'm leaving it all in.
But that's fine. That's what I normally get called. So
Albury.
But Albury. I don't expect you to get it right.
No,
in the first 10 times.
I expect you to get it right. So I'm Daniel Ferrugia or Ferrugia or Ferrugio, which I quite often
there
get.
There we go. So variations.
Yeah, I've had them all. And my favourite is people just don't even, they get halfway through and they just give up.
Yeah. It's like just leave your name on the floor.
Daniel?
Yeah, just call me Dan. Yeah.
But anyway, often children will just call me Mr. F because when I was teaching, because it's easier.
There you go.
But, you know, as we were saying, so you've come over, you came to Australia, you've obviously, and then you work. You came over working, did you, or were you?
Actually, no. I found a job on the internet working for a pizza shop, but in their technology department. So technology is my background. Programming, software engineering is what I did at uni. So that was what I came over as a software engineer for a pizza chain. so not the most glamorous. But it was more for the adventure than the work.
Yeah. And where did you live when you first came to Australia?
So in Adelaide, in South Australia. At that time, I didn't even know really where Adelaide was or anything about it. It was kind of on the way to Sydney for me.
There's lots of people who live in Australia and still don't know
exactly right. So yes, I don't feel so bad about that now. But then I never got to Sydney. Adelaide was such a great place that I ended up staying, and that's where I am now. So yeah, it was that was really an adventure in itself. Getting over here, not knowing quite where I was going. But I like adventure.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, where we're sitting in your beautiful home right now, and we're looking out the window and I can literally see the trail. And I think that says a lot about, it's the first time I've actually recorded a podcast for the Trail Runners Experience with a direct line of sight to the trail.
With a genuine trail.
I reckon we could be on the dirt in under a minute, if we had to. Maybe 2 minutes if there's a bit of traffic.
And that's got to get across. Exactly, this is what the little road to cross. But you can taste the trails.
Yeah, so it's good. You've got your iconic gum trees. The view out your balcony is iconically Australian, isn't it?
It is. And even in Australia, a lot of people don't get that kind of backyard, and the animals that go with it. So it's a pretty special place. And is why we moved up here as trail runners, to be able to access the trails so easily.
Brilliant. Yeah, no, it's I love it. And it's one of the reasons why I live where I live. And, I would live in a cardboard box if I had such good access to the trails.
Same.
It's location, location, location.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we moved here from Europe. Going back to what you said before. So I moved out here many years ago. Went back to Europe for a number of 15 years. Had a family, and then we moved back here right in the heat of COVID time. And that's partly why we moved back to the trails as well. Because when you're living in a city, center of a city, and you can't go anywhere, and you're locked down, and all that, the desire for a space where you could go out and just have access to nature was pretty high. So that's why we moved up here with the trails literally out the door.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, so you came over with your family, your wife, and you've got two young children.
Yeah.
And you had said you'd been living in Europe, specifically in Germany.
In Berlin, Germany, correct, yeah.
And that's what took you to Germany? Was it a work thing?
So I used to live there many years ago as a kid, before the wall came down. Those that are old enough to remember, there was a wall around Berlin.
Oh, really? Yeah. So that's really cool. So it's cool that it came down, but it's very interesting that you lived there.
So I lived there in the 80s as a young kid and always wanted to go back. My wife learned German to a very high proficiency in Australia and wanted to go to Germany. So that's why we decided to move to Berlin for shits and giggles. Intending to stay for maybe a year. But we spent 15 years there, had kids, the whole bit.
Yeah, wow. I've never been to Berlin, but I hear it's an amazing cultural city,
Absolutely, yeah. It's obviously got the history that most of us would know, Second World War, obviously, but way back, it's almost 800 years old, the city. So there's a lot of rich history there. There's a lot of nature, which surprises me, a lot of forests and lakes. So it's a fascinating place, and it's very liberal. It's relatively inexpensive. It's a pretty chilled out place, which can surprise people in Germany.
Yeah, really. How did you find living among, you're a pretty chilled out, laid back guy. So do you feel like you fit in well in that regard, or do you think that it influenced you as a person? Or nowhere's perfect,
Sure, yeah. Well, I think there's a mix there, because although it's the capital of Germany, there's a lot of expats. There's a big tech startup scene over there. So
I suppose
there's a big.
It's a big city, isn't it? It's an international.
It's a very international city, exactly right. So I guess that's part of what people that go there like about it. It is very international, so it's probably not typically German in that regard, which is odd considering it's the capital. But then it's probably no different to London or Sydney in that way. They're a real melting pot of people, those cities. Yeah. And I think Berlin is no different. You get everything that's good about that. You get people that aren't there for a long time. So people there for a good time, not a long time. So you get great friends, but then they're gone in 2 years. So you have to constantly make new friends.
Which is a blessing and a curse, I imagine.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's very cool. I had, I suppose, a similar experience in my time when I lived in Tokyo, Japan. So I lived there,
right.
But I lived there for just a bit over a year. So I, as opposed to staying for 15 years, I did stay for the year, and it was that same kind of vibe, very international.
Yeah,
a lot of expats.
Yeah,
even though Japan's probably an even more insular country,
right?
But it was really fascinating being in like such a massive city.
And, yeah,
yeah. So it's different. It's hard to describe. Even coming back to Australia and I lived in Sydney for a while, and Sydney's big and chaotic, but it's just on a different scale to a place like Tokyo.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah. 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 Well, Berlin. I mean, it's a big city, but it's not like I'm pretty sure not like Tokyo. It's
no.
Definitely like Sydney or London. It's it's pretty chilled out. You don't get a sense of everyone's super busy going about their business. People just seem to walk around the place, and there doesn't seem to be that intensity, if you like, that you see in other cities,
yeah.
which I like.
Yeah, that's awesome. We're talking because you've got an interesting sort of story of a project that you're doing soon, but obviously you're a runner, and that's a big
right.
part of why I've got you
yes.
here. And so where did that sort of all start?
Yeah, well, yeah, without sort of maybe taking too long to talk about it, because it's quite a journey for me. And it's interesting being called a runner, because I never really think of myself as a runner. Because when I was a kid, I used to have like chronic asthma. So running was something I always avoided and was like actively avoided and was encouraged to avoid by the doctors at the time. And it was always managed through medication. And as I got older, I kind of came to this realization that that was it for me. I would always have to avoid running or any kind of physical exertion and just increase my meds over time. That was what I was doing into my 20s. So as an adult, I didn't grow out of it, as doctors said you probably would. So we moved back to Europe, as I said, and to Berlin. But on the way to Berlin, we actually went to London for a bit. And when I was there, I decided I would try and get into running. I thought, I need to increase my fitness. I want to get off these drugs for asthma. And I started running. And I hated it.
Yep.
It gave me asthma attacks every time. And I was only probably running a kilometer. I mean, it's almost a joke now. But that was my journey. And I kept going with it. And I kept going with it. And I actually found that by listening to music, I could distract myself and not get the asthma attacks. So I kind of found out about this other approach, rather than try and avoid the trigger running, except that I would get asthma as I was running but not be able to hear it in a way. And I found that worked, and I was able to go further and further. And then fast forward to now, I've run mountain marathons and the whole bit. And asthma has disappeared, and I now take no medication. So that's the very quick.
That's brilliant. So you increased your aerobic strength, essentially. My older brother had a similar kind of story with his asthma. I didn't know you had asthma. And, he grew up really bad asthma.
Right.
But then a doctor had said something different to your doctor, and was like, maybe he should take up swimming or
sure.
something.
Sure, yeah, that's common, actually. I hear that nowadays.
And so he was doing a bit of swimming, but then he got into lots of other sports like soccer and, now he surfs, and he's got an enormous lung capacity. He does,
right.
You know, and to be quite honest, I don't think he's used his Ventolin in years. And so,
okay.
So it's definitely testament. So use it or lose it kind of mentality.
Yeah. You know? Well, and one thing that I got from that whole experience, which I still use a lot these days, was the mental game. And people talk about that a lot in running. You know, you can get physically fit and that can take you so far. But mentally, you know, that's what I learned from getting rid of asthma. It wasn't the running in itself that cured me. It was changing my mindset towards asthma and being, rather than just getting an attack and panicking and stopping and then trying to then take the drugs to remove it. It was accepting I'm going to get it and learning how to relax, how to breathe, and how to distract myself. All mental games, and that was the secret to the success, which I use a lot now. Understanding the power of your mind,
yeah,
and what you can do and how that can help your running, even though it's not running per se.
Fascinating. Yeah, no, it's very much a mental game in like improving your fitness generally. And so it's brilliant. Well, I'm glad that you're feeling stronger. And so now, and that's allowed you to do a lot of wild things. And I mean, I know there's a lot we can talk about, and I do want to talk about, but we might just jump ahead to what we're doing, what we're preparing for at the moment. So you're heading over to Europe in
July, so that's 3 months from now.
And you've started a project called Project
Alprun.
Alprun.
That's right,
Project Alprun, what is it?
So it's a project to run across the Alps. There are many ways you can do it. The way I'm going to do it is to basically run from the northern side, from the Swiss side to the south side, the Italian side, about 1,000 kilometers. And I'm going to do it in 30 days unsupported, which means I don't have a support crew carrying my gear. I don't have anyone booking me accommodation or feeding me. I have to get myself from the start to the end. So that's the basic premise.
Yeah. It's wild. So it's 1,000 kilometers in 30 days.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it could have been 860, but I decided to make it a nice clean 1,000 because it sounds better.
Sounds beautiful. Yeah. It's a long way. I was thinking about the biggest month of training I've ever done, and it's only just about half that. So that puts it in perspective.
Yeah.
And like that, I remember that month that I did that, and it was during COVID. And I remember thinking how bloody hard that was.
Well, so, the thing is, you're saying that, but you've done that. I haven't done what I'm going to do. So I can sit here and say, oh yeah, what I'm doing is far bigger, but I haven't got it under my belt yet. So it's all to play for.
Well, what makes you think you can do it? I know it sounds like
Well, that's a good question, because I think it's like, you know, those of us that have done a marathon, how do you know you can do it till you've done it? Because most people that run a marathon haven't done one before they do one. So there's a huge element of that. But for me, going back to what I was saying before, the mental game, that's a big, big part of it. So I am running. I'm probably not running enough, to be honest, but I have been focusing a lot over the past couple of years, particularly on the mental game, building my mental capacity, my stamina, mentally, to be able to take on the challenge. Because I've done a lot of mountain running before. I've done multi-day mountain running, never this extreme. But that whole experience has taught me that you can set off on a lovely sunny morning and go for a run, but then you're up in the mountains, weather changes, you get lost, all these other things can happen. And how do you work with that? So for me, a lot of it is kind of building that mental resilience and building that ability to be flexible, especially in a hostile environment, or what can be a hostile environment.
Yeah, and I guess it's also framing things differently and sort of going, rather than going, oh, I've still got 50 kilometers to run or whatever, you could say, I get to run another 50 kilometers in this.
Yes.
You know, so you know, rather than it being, seeing it as a chore, seeing it as a privilege. You know,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. 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 And I think that's anyone that does any kind of running will know that, you know, if you go out for a run and mentally you're doing 10K, when you get to 10K, you're kind of mentally about done because you've done what you set out to do. If you set out to do 20K, when you get to 10K, you feel quite different than if you'd done the 10K, even though you've still done 10K. But why is that? Because mentally you're prepared for something different.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that just shows a little bit of an essence of the mentalness.
Yeah, I always think it would be fun. It's a bit like those last one standing races, but you don't know what the finish line is.
Yes.
But the mental game of that is tough because you go, I don't know when this is going to end.
Yes.
You know?
And yes. So. Well, and there's a lot of people have written books on it, a lot more about it than I do, but this idea that you've got this governor that I think cuts you off at about 60% of what you're capable of to preserve you, and you can actually unlock this huge potential in yourself that your body kind of likes to preserve.
It was absolutely. It was, well, human body is the central governor theory, which was, I think, developed by Phil Noakes. He wrote some amazing work on running. Some of the stuff he's written lately has been a little bit questionable and has drawn a lot of criticism.
Right.
Especially in the time of COVID.
Okay.
He's become a little bit of a COVID, COVID denier. But his work on the central governor theory is amazing in terms of, it's just like whether it's true or not, it's an amazing way to think because it's sort of, absolutely. But the human body its number one focus and the brain's number one focus is to keep you alive.
Exactly right.
You know?
Exactly right.
It will deliberately shut down things.
Yeah, it will shut you down.
Yeah, it'll shut, and it starts with the most non-essential part. So it'll, yeah, maybe you could argue that cramping is a way of stopping you from dying. You know, there's,
absolutely.
Anyway, it's absolutely fascinating, that stuff. And I love that that's the approach. And so, what about logistically, like going into this, you're covering, it's not exactly the same distance that you're going to run every day.
No, it changes.
It's specific.
Exactly right. Yeah. There's huge variance day to day.
Do you know how much sort of elevation gain loss you'll get over the whole month?
So the first 200 Ks is relatively flat. That's what I'm calling the fun run. Anyone that knows the Berkeley marathons will know that they have this concept of an extreme part of it is called a fun run.
The first 200
So I'm calling K. the first 200K of my 1,000 the fun run because it's relatively flat, 50K a day, but not much elevation. That's to get to the base of the mountains, basically.
And that's by running by that lake.
So it's starting in Zurich, along the Lake Zurich, and basically along the northern flank of the Alps to kind of get in to where the trail really starts. And once I get into there, so the next 800, I'm averaging a K and a half of ascent a day.
Yeah.
So some days are a few hundred meters. One day I've got 5K of ascent. That's the biggest day. So, yeah, huge variation.
That's huge, yeah. So, yeah, so you're, I'm just sort of trying to see what that would feel like. I'm not sure if you're familiar, you know, Eddie Izzard.
Yes.
I think...
A fellow Brit.
Fellow Brit. Well, so actually, at the risk of being getting in trouble, he no longer goes by Eddie because now Eddie is a woman, trans.
Yes, yes.
Anyway, I'm not sure what Eddie's name is, but for the sake of Eddie Izzard, the comedian,
yes.
Did a big run around the UK.
Doing like a marathon a day.
Yeah, and he was incredibly unfit.
Yes.
When he started.
Yes.
But by the end, he got fitter.
He got fitter, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's when you said that because...
Made it easier.
Yeah, well, when you say about how are you ready for this, I think that there's a big part of that. The scale of it means that as you get going, as you get more into it, your body will adapt to what you're doing. I'm a big believer in that. There'll be difficult times for sure, but an adaption will occur during that time because of the sheer time that you're doing it every day. I mean, I've done a lot of that with anyone that's done any kind of training at altitude. You know, your body within a couple of days starts to adapt to altitude very quickly. This is kind of the same principle. So the longer I'm going, the more my body is going to adapt.
Yeah.
Adapt or die. I mean, it'll adapt or it'll fail on me and that'll be the end. But...
Do you worry about the risk ever? Like the actual, like, is there a point where you'll go, okay, my life and my family are too valuable, I'm going to pull the pin?
You know,
at what point are you going to, obviously you're not going to do anything stupid, but at what point do you go, no, this is not worth the risk?
Sure. Well, I think it's hard to know without getting to that point, but I think, the more experience you have with doing things like this, risk is relative, of course, and it's how you manage your risk, how comfortable you feel with that level of risk, whether you consider that to be within your wheelhouse or whether you consider that to be beyond, and you have to make that call. Of course, in extreme environments, you can make bad decisions. For example, you're on a mountaintop, you need to get to the next point, but you're on the wrong mountaintop, so you've now got to go all the way back to the bottom and round, or maybe you can try and cut down this gorge to get across. Well, that might be shorter, but that would be hugely dangerous. Maybe there's no trail, maybe it's straight rockfall kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not a good idea. Maybe the weather's just changed as well, playing into it, you make bad decisions. So to try and not do that, but again, that's through experience, it's through understanding risk and how you adapt to it.
Yeah.
So it's hard to know what that level really is until you hit that.
Yeah. I'm sure you've got strategy, like safety, you're taking safety protocols of sorts.
Exactly right. Yeah. So having done mountain races before where the weather can be, it can be 30 degrees centigrade in the valleys because I'm going in European summer, but then you could get a blizzard up in the mountains. So you've got everything in between. So you have to carry all the gear. And then I'm unsupported, so I have to take a satellite tracker with a GPS beacon feature. So there is that kind of rescue option, although it's not a guarantee. You know, you can't assume someone's going to come and get you in a time frame that will save you. You know,
yeah.
If you get a difficulty,
you need to know how to wait.
You
know,
you need to have survival gear and all that stuff. So again, that's managing the risk. You know, that's all part of managing that risk by being prepared. But being able to adapt to change.
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, there was a certain element of it when I hear you talk about it. It excites me and it makes me want to do something similar, even though I've never really entertained that until recently, going on just these big solo missions, because I think there's something deep inside of all humans that wants to get wild. You know, get out there and just, because it's a singular focus. You're going to get out there and you're going to... it's just you wake up, run all day, and then you sleep.
So you're very much in the moment. You're very much...
There's nothing else.
Exactly right. And I think you've hit on something there that I'm a big believer in. This is what makes humans what they are.
Yeah.
You know, by living in the moment and how we can adapt to change, that's a big thing, I think, as being a human. And I think it's a big thing that in modern societies, it's difficult to get now.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. I've read these studies where as societies get more danger averse and more things get put in place to make it more difficult for you to hurt yourself, more people crave activities where they can hurt themselves, you know, whether it's be downhill mountain biking or whatever. And there's a drive up in those kind of sports as the world gets, you know, safer in quotes.
Yeah. And I mean, everyone's looking for a bit of a dopamine hit, you know, and that, but I think it goes even deeper than that, because I feel like there's a certain primal energy to it.
And to be challenged, that's a big part of it as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of thinking of people try and set themselves up in an environment where they don't get challenged. It's what they know. They don't have what they think will be the stress of challenge, but actually through manageable challenges which you can succeed, not that overwhelm you, challenges where you can achieve them, you get a tremendous high and you can then go on to something else and something else and something else, rather than actively avoid them actually. And of course you set the bar to where you are, slightly above possibly, and that's where you really find the magic.
Yeah.
Know, whether it's traveling and you don't know a language and you need to order a pastry, you know, that's the challenge. And you do it and you get, and yet that, it doesn't have to be running up a mountain or anything. I mean, it really doesn't. It's just having a challenge.
Exactly. It's what, and I think without goals, I'll rephrase that. So when we have goals, it helps us put in place a process, you know, to achieve. And then that, for me, is the getting to that point, whether it's people training for a half marathon or a 1,000-kilometer run through the Alps, the preparation is just as enriching as the experience.
The journey. And I think that's that you've hit on another thing there, I think, about the journey. You know, everyone talks about it, I know, but, you know, the destination of the journey, I mean, enjoy it, embrace the journey. So this is... the seed of this was about 10 years ago for me. And so it's been a journey, not like every day, but it's been something in my mind, I would say most days, that I'm going to do this one day. And it's taken me almost 10 years to get to the start line. But that's the journey. I mean, I've been enjoying that process and what I've picked up along the way, and I haven't even done it yet.
Yeah. And it's wild, it's scary, but it also... It's just you're breaking it down into bite-sized chunks as well. You know, you're not going to. I mean, I'm sure there will be a point, especially early on, when you go, "Shit, I've got 1,000 kilometers to go."
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, there'll probably be many, many moments like that.
Yeah,
yeah.
But then you just got to go, okay, I'm going to just focus on the here and now, as we said before.
And I think that's a big, something of that scale, I think that's exactly right. You've got to focus more on the moment and where you are and getting through that. Because if you don't get through each day, you won't get to the next. I mean, it sounds obvious.
Yeah.
But if you think too much about what's coming up next and not where you are now, you can make mistakes in the now and not get to the next.
Yeah.
You know, that's a reality.
Absolutely. So another thing, you've got a really good incentive too. So it's called Project Alp Run, but what's the other drive, aside from your own personal goals, there's another motive behind it.
Yeah. So it's it's for charity as well. It's actually to raise money to plant trees. So you can donate to plant some trees because, you know, it's selfish in a way. It's something I want to do as a personal challenge, but it feels like it's too big to go off for 30 days in the mountains just for me. I want it to be something big. I want to promote nature, connecting with nature, connecting with yourself, and doing something for the environment in a positive way. Planting trees is very universal. I think everyone around the world gets that.
Yeah.
More trees is good. So that's the charity I'm working with, a tree planting charity.
So, I mean, I'll put all the information when we post this episode. It'll be in the show notes, and we'll put it on social media because I think it's an awesome incentive. So with the trees, where specifically will the trees be planted, and who's planting them? And
yeah,
so tell us about that.
So they're called Trees for the Future, and they're mostly in North Africa, and basically they pay communities to grow the saplings, the little trees, to plant them and then look after them. It's not just throwing some tree seeds at the back of a plane while it flies over a bit of desert. It's the whole life cycle of a tree.
To turn them into established trees.
Yeah, and ultimately forests that people can live with, because a lot of the environments where they're focused on planting trees are where people have chopped down trees because that's how they get their fuel. That's how they build their homes. And of course, as they do that, they degrade the land, the crops fail, and droughts are more common. And as you scale that up over massive areas, they change ecosystems, change everything. So by replanting trees and then living with the trees, managing the trees, planting food crops within the trees, sustainable environments sort of come from that. So they're trying to plant like a billion trees. I mean, there are other charities doing the same thing. It's not like this is the only one, but Trees the Future, the one I've paired with. They are an amazing organization. And as I'm out in nature, and as you said at the beginning, I've got the trails outside my door. I kind of feel connected to the trees.
Well, there's a definite energy that comes from.
I'd like some more, and that's it. Yeah, and I'm a big believer. I actually work for a company where we work for charities, and a big thing in the charity or fundraising space is that just throwing money at problems won't make the problems go away. You need to connect on a deeper level with the cause, with the issue.
Yeah.
So in the case of trees, you need to get people out into nature, into the environment, to care for the trees, to then want to plant more trees. So yes, I'm trying to raise money to plant more trees, but in what I'm doing, I want more people to follow what I'm doing, like this podcast, talk about it, talk about these challenges and get more people inspired to challenge themselves, ideally with something in nature, you know, going for a walk, going for a run, whatever, and connecting with the natural environment. And that, therefore, the care will come from that, rather than just say, hey, throw money at planting trees.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And I mean, you're just like the Lorax, really. You're familiar with the Lorax? You speak for the trees?
Speak for the trees.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's great because, I mean, I think it's so pertinent to trail runners because, you know, the trails would be pretty mediocre if there were no trees.
Yeah.
You know, it's part of what makes it interesting. Like we live here in Adelaide. And, you know, what's in the trees? We see birds, we see koalas.
Yeah.
And, you know, the trees themselves are obviously the lungs of the earth.
Exactly right. You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
And essentially because, you know, we're separated, we're talking now, one road between the developed environment and then beautiful nature. And in the environment where I'm living, you know, there are problems of people poisoning trees. I've heard injecting fuel, gasoline, petrol into trees to kill them, you know, chopping down trees because they drop leaves in the pool.
Yeah.
The point is, this huge disconnect of why we need trees. They can often be seen in the built environment as something that is annoying, a hindrance.
Yeah.
But you know, that's crazy. Let's get people, you know, connected to the trees, understanding why they're a good thing.
I mean, seriously, you know, who hasn't, like, you know, sometimes you just stumble upon like a big like gum tree or something. I don't know. There's a few around, and though these big gum trees, they're generally big, but every now and again you stumble on like an enormous tree, and it is pretty awe-inspiring.
Yeah.
You're just like, you know, what that tree has lived through, you know. And the other day I was walking down the street in an urban area here in Adelaide, and there was a, because a few weeks ago we had a big windstorm.
Yeah.
And there were lots of trees that got blown down, and there was enormous, I came across this tree that had been cut down at the base.
Right.
And because I think what, because the house next to it, there was a lot of damage, and you could see part of the tree had obviously fallen on the roof.
Right. Okay. And, so it's then down with the tree. Yeah.
So the tree had to be put down.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it's really sad. And I was with my wife and we counted the rings. It was really quite difficult because they say you count the rings.
That's right. Yeah.
And it was, I mean, the thing, this thing had a, it would have had a circumference around of several meters. It was huge.
Right.
And it was, there was, and we sort of lost count at about 50 rings.
Yeah, okay.
You know? So it's, and we so weren't 50 even.
50 plus years old, yeah.
It was probably closer to 150 years old. It was huge. And just sort of look at, the, I mean, you know, that tree was there first. And I don't know. I don't know the answer in terms of, I feel like we need to build homes that are going to be a bit more.
With the, I think that that's a good point, actually. I think
yeah.
that's the thing, building into the environment, not over the environment.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you know, it's a different way of thinking. And I think that's part of it, adapting to the environment rather than trying to terraform it into something that you want it to be.
Yeah. And there's a, I know in local council areas here in Adelaide, there is a, there's specific diameter where a tree is protected. You know, once a tree gets above a certain diameter,
right,
it's classified as a significant tree.
Yeah, yeah, and it would take 50 plus years to get another one. So,
yeah.
You know, can we wait that long?
Exactly. So, you know, there was a, I see lots of, and it's something that does upset me a bit, especially part of the reason we live, because, I mean, we don't live actually that far from each other, which is amazing. And it's, and so part of the reason where I live around here is because of the proximity. We live in a very tree-lined suburb, you know.
Yeah.
I love all the trees in our streets and stuff and up and then into the hills. And I sort of think, this is the reason we live here. And then just to see, you know, there goes one tree, there goes another tree. It's like,
You know. Oh, it's a common problem. And the thing is with picking trees, I mean, it's in some ways obvious, but if you look at a lot of, you know, issues around the world, you know, you can – to some degree, you can roll them back to trees. More trees creates a healthier environment, healthier ecosystem, and all these things. You know, we're talking back to the asthma stuff, you know, a lot of that, you know, pollution, and, you know, trees can clean a lot of the air. And there are so many, you know, mental, physical issues that face us as humanity now. You know, again, more trees has a direct improvement, which we can talk about, but there are things which, you know, over a longer time, it can then fix. They can fix other problems,
and
other issues.
We need to think about things on a time scale that are going to go beyond our lifetime.
Yeah, you know? That's so, exactly right.
And
it is
hard for people to see that, though. No, it's really good. Say the name of the website again, and we'll
so it's projectoutrun.com.
Yep.
Is the website I put together for my run, where you can follow the progress when it starts in July. It's live now. But it'll really get exciting when I start off on the 19th of July.
Will you have a separate social media, or is it all just going to go via the website?
There'll be some at social media to set up as well. That's to come.
Yeah, cool.
That's the thing with these projects. There's so much to do. You start off thinking, I just need a better run, but then you realise that's just one part.
Yeah, I think you need to have a social media presence in this day and age. It's a necessary evil, but it's... think you want to get your message.
It's the planning and it's the adapt. And in fact, we were talking a bit before about I was talking about the mental and the adaptability and this sort of stuff, because one little quote I love, which, and I'm not very good at remembering quotes like jokes, but Mike Tyson was once asked when going into a fight what his plan for the fight was.
Yeah.
And his response was something like, your plan goes out the window as soon as you get punched in the face.
Exactly.
You know, and I think you can take that in one of two ways. Don't plan because things are going to change anyway, or rather make a plan but accept that you will need to adapt your plan and be able to change accordingly. And I take away from that exactly that.
Exactly.
All the planning goes in as much as you can, but at the end of the day, when you start, things will happen. and how you can prepare yourself for things not going quite as you wanted when you get punched in the face, so exactly. to speak.
So, yeah, you may get punched in the face numerous times.
Yes. Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
I hope that that month is, you know, beautiful weather from from the start to finish. This is what I wanted to ask you, because I want to ask you about your training, but what's the highest point in the race or in the run that you're doing? Like how?
Well, the mountains go up to, about 5,000 meters. The highest point, I probably won't get over 4,000.
It's still very high.
Yeah, it's still very, there's a couple of mountains which I'm still debating which way to go, but I probably won't go over 4,000 meters. But high enough.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's extreme. I know from experience, just being in New Zealand recently, even getting up to just below 2,000 meters, there's a significant weather change, temperature change.
Definitely, yeah, yeah.
And then obviously...
And you can feel the altitude. Everyone's different, but you can actually...
Yeah, the oxygen's reduced. So, yeah, I guess that's something you'll just have to approach when you get there.
And that will adapt, because it's up and down every day. There's the ability to adapt to the altitude quite quickly.
Yeah, and another quick question about that is, where will you sleep?
Yeah, well, that's so. Originally, my plan was to stay, because it's when you're up, there are a lot of huts you can stay in. In the Alps, there are a lot of huts which serve hot food and have bunk rooms you can sleep in. And then down in the valleys, there are villages and you basically B&Bs or little farm stays you can stay in. So originally, I was going to do that the whole way, but as I've got further into it, I want this kind of deeper experience. So now I've got a little micro sleeping bag and what's called a bivy bag. It's like a little waterproof sack. And I'm going to mix it up now between sleeping rough, sleeping wild, and sleeping in huts. So it'll be a bit of a mix. And the mix, I don't know quite what the percentage is yet until I get out there, how I feel.
Yeah.
But it's going to be a mix.
That's wild. So you might just stop where you are and sleep sometimes.
Yeah, well, I've got a plan. Every day of the 30 days is planned out. I have a finish point on each day. And so I can always finish. I can always sleep at a hut. But the mountain huts, if the weather's nice, you can actually have a meal and then go outside and sleep.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's sheltered and it's a warm evening, you can do that. You don't have to pay for the night. So sometimes I'll be sleeping in a kind of a safer environment like that.
Yeah.
And then other times I'll be in the middle of a forest.
Yeah, right. And you've tested out your bivy bag.
Yes, I've been testing it where I live. So I've gone down to sort of relatively cool nights of about 10 degrees centigrade. And as I'm going in summer, that's the kind of nighttime temperatures I would expect. But for those that don't know the flora and fauna of the Alps, I'm running through Slovenia, one of the countries where they still have an active population of bears. There's about 2,000 brown bears living out there, which you'd be lucky to see.
Yeah.
They say that because most people do a day hike, day trip in and in and out, but I'll be living in the mountains there for a few days.
Yeah.
So the chances of seeing a brown bear is probably a little higher. I don't know if that's good or bad. I probably don't want to see one too close.
So you've got to do some speed work. Or are you supposed to run from a brown bear, or do you stand still?
You know, it depends what you read. And at the moment it happens, you probably want to be pretty sure of what you want to do. But then again, you probably want to adapt to what's coming. But I think the school of thought generally now is that you want to show you're not a threat, so backing away is seen to be a good idea. Never turn your back and run. Back away slowly. If the bear comes for you, then they can climb better than you can. They can run faster and swim faster than you. So you then want to make yourself as big and loud as you can to basically show the bear, hey, I'm going to be a challenge, even though you're probably not.
No, yeah.
If it gets to the wire like that, you're probably best trying to do that, because nothing else.
So
is
this
will be
that's
work.
One of those getting punched in the face moments.
This is exactly right. And it's rolling back into that, another thing I do is I do kung fu as a martial art.
Ah, yes.
And a big part of that isn't for the martial part as much, which is the fighting part. It's more the flow, and it's more the reacting to the force that you receive. And the bear punch in the face thing is a big part of that, because you do all the training and then you do sparring where you get punched in the face, and you in your mind before that happens, you go, well, I'm going to do this move and I'm going to do that move. And maybe that would start off well, but typically it doesn't go like that in a more of a fight situation. It's a lot more free flowing and it doesn't go your way, and you get hit in the face. And then what do you do? And that's, you know, that's part of so I kind of think of that maybe as a little bit of my bear training if the bear does come at me, but I don't know.
That's, well, I hope that you don't see any bears, and if you do, that they're friendly and like Yogi Bee Bear.
Yeah.
Is it Yogi Bee Bear? No, Yogi Bear.
Or yeah,
Humphrey
yeah.
Bee Bear.
Humphrey Bee Bear and Yogi Bear.
Yeah.
Yogi Bear.
Are you, yeah, so tell me about the Kung Fu, because I know part of, because I want to get into your training a little bit and how you, because you've got a few months to go still. I suppose you've been ramping up a little, but you've been doing Kung Fu for a few years?
Yeah, so I did it many years ago as a young adult and then stopped it for a while and I got back into it a couple of years ago. But again, not for the martial, the fighting part so much, but more because the traditional Chinese styles, the Kung Fu styles, are a lot more internal than external. So what that means is a lot more mind-body connection that you focus on. And it's all about reacting to changes in force. So it's all touch. It's all about touch. There's not this sort of, I'm going to come at you and do a flying kick. It's nothing like that. It's something comes to you and how you manage the force that comes to you and typically put it away. So I think you can apply that to many things in life. And what I'm applying it to is my running. So what that means specifically is if I'm running on a trail or down a trail and I'm on stones and it's steep and I'm trying to get my feet moving in a nice way, the flow, if you like, that's what my Kung Fu helps with, because it projects you a lot more forward on your feet, forward in your mind, and able to move light, move free, move loosely, all these sorts of things. You really help you with your Kung Fu, because a lot of it is focusing left and right brain connection and brain connecting to body.
That agility.
And it's agility. Yeah. So all this stuff, it's not like, you know, as I say, the fighting is really one part of it. But as I've realized, there's a much deeper level. I mean, it goes back almost something like 5,000 years, these martial arts styles. People have been doing them for many years. And in fact, if you look at something like Tai Chi, which is very similar to what I practice.
Yeah.
That was a very effective martial art, fighting art, but now it's almost exclusively an art without the martial. People do it very slow, very meditatively, as a relaxing thing to do, because of this tremendous mind-body connection that it promotes. So people, there's almost no one now that practices it as a martial art, because what a lot of people use it for, as I say, is the art, is that mind-body connection, that meditative style that it's really become.
Have you seen the movie Roadhouse with Patrick Swayze?
I don't think so.
From back in the 80s. And so he was, it's a great movie. I haven't seen it for a very long time, but he was a Tai Chi expert. And he worked as a bouncer in a roadhouse and it was like lots of fighting and it was all Tai Chi. And he was like, but he was like super calm and he's like,
right.
But then he's like, I'm gonna mess you up. It's like, but I'm gonna do it calmly.
I'm gonna calmly mess you up.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's like the golden era of Swayze. You know?
The 80s was a golden time.
Yeah. But no, that's really wild. I did do karate for some time.
Yes.
And similar kind of. I mean, it's probably fundamentally very similar. Like
it comes from the same place ultimately. Yeah. Well, I think most martial arts.
Well, karate. Kara means empty and te is hand. And okay. So karate do is the way of the empty hand.
Yes.
And so because they weren't allowed to have weapons and so they learned how to. So and a lot of it is about transfer of energy. And so when people, you know, if someone's coming at you, you know, it's more about using their own energy against them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, using their own energy against. And for those who are on the martial art, slight theme. You know, I grew up with Bruce Lee as a martial arts force back in the day, and one of his sayings was, you know, be like water.
Yeah.
And that was as a practitioner, and he did the same style that I do, Wing Chun, and I love that again, that idea that you want to flow like water. And yes, that was in the martial art context, but you know, he was also a dancer and an amazing athlete. And I think you can apply it to pretty much anything you do. When you go through your daily life, you go through your environment being like water.
There's a few ways I've just taken that. What does that mean? What, like, be like water?
I think it's about, again, it comes down to the environment where you're a lot more connected with it. You're flowing through it. So, you know, you're on the trails, which are like little rivers, you know, they go, they go around, maybe not up so much, if it's a river, but down and round. And I think that idea that you flow through your environment, you move through it in a natural way, and you don't try and resist it. You go through it.
It's interesting, and I also take it from that. Enough water can be very powerful as well. Like the power of water.
That's true.
But also the one of the things, and I think about this with training a lot actually, is it's the path of least, and water will take the path of least resistance.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, that is a good on you, Bruce. No, Bruce Lee. Yeah. He's a philosopher. He had the philosophy.
Well, he did have a philosopher mindset as well. Yeah. There was many things.
Which is probably part of the reason why he was such an incredible athlete, you know?
He was a real tour de force, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, that's awesome. I could probably talk for another hour about
I know, there's so much
arts.
In this.
It's fascinating. And look, it's definitely, for me to go back, I have this fascination with getting back into karate at some point, because I was a bit like you. I started in my 20s. And then I've given it away, but I said perhaps I'll come back into it at some stage.
Yes.
I do remember seeing like people in their 70s at my dojo that had that were getting their black belts and stuff like that, and they'd only they'd only been doing it. A lot of them only started in their 50s or 60s.
Yes.
And then so it's not some. It's about when you. It's not about like when you start.
Just start. Yeah. I think that you can again apply that to many things, but that's the thing. Yeah, it's never too late. Just start your journey, whatever it is.
Yeah, running,
and you'll feel better for it.
Yeah, and so speaking of your journey, so the path forward from here until your big run.
Yes,
you've obviously got to get yourself into a pretty good state of fitness, and you are a very fit person already. And I would dare say
getting there.
Yeah, so. What's your? Do you have a bit of a plan of attack with training in the next?
Yeah, so the next 3 months are going to be focused on distance. Now I feel I've done all the other stuff.
Yeah.
Now it's building up the distance. So doing the plus 30K runs and then get up and do another one kind of thing. Start to build that up.
Yeah.
And get the body ready for the feeling of that.
Yeah.
Because that it hasn't had that feeling.
Yeah.
Before.
That's. Yeah, and dealing and starting fatigued.
Yeah. And also when you sleep rough, I've done a bit of this training already, but have a run, have a sleep, and then get up and do another run and sleep rough, and then that it's hard to get going when you first get up off the ground and it's cold.
Yeah, and you haven't had an optimal night's sleep, so
it's, you have a good night's sleep in some ways because you've got the stars and it's very relaxing in that regard, but it's not comfortable at the same time, because you're sleeping on hard ground and you probably wake up a few times in the night because it's just, even though it's not freezing, it's cold, so that does wake you up in the night, and any noises will also wake you up. It's a much more primeval experience.
Yeah.
And you go straight back to sleep again, but you don't get 7-8 whatever hours continuous and wake up refreshed.
I think you'll adapt. I guess that is a challenge. Are you planning on doing more like overnight?
I've done a few already, but I'm going to be doing a few more. And again, that's testing the gear, getting my pack up to the full weight of everything I want to take, which includes solar panels and all sorts of bits and pieces.
Brilliant.
I haven't done the training with absolutely everything yet. Water filtration, just many things. Some training with that and the distance and the overnight. So I've got a bit of work still to do.
Yeah, I think you'll get there. And I think I think the most important thing is just keeping your general fitness is quite high, and you're a super active person. And as you say, you'll just be like water.
Be like water.
Yeah,
that's it.
And with your training as well. Like just don't. Don't force it. It'll come. Yeah. You'll get there. And
that's. I'm just finishing on that point. If you're in the run race mindset, you really are focused on getting to the end and probably in a half decent time. But I can't focus like that because it's just too long. My focus is really, I only have to get to the end, and I've got a day to get there.
Yeah.
So whether it takes me 7 hours or 12 hours,
yeah,
I can still do it. So it's changing that mindset a bit and not rushing, slowing down. Talk about water taking the path of least resistance. That's what's important. I have to get through each day. If I get through a day and I'm 2 hours ahead of schedule, that doesn't help me for the next day.
No, there's no, you're not trying to set an FKT.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
So
no, it's brilliant. That's excellent, Matt. What we might do is we might put a pin in it now, but I think that when we get either after you've done this massive thing, we should have a chat, and I think people will be really interested to see how it all went, and you can debrief about it. But in the meantime, they can follow your journey on Project Alprun.
ProjectAlprun.com.
ProjectAlprun.com, and I will share all that information on my on the show notes and whatnot, and we'll see how you go from there.
Thank you. if I come back, I'll either be eating humble pie or I'll be building on everything I just talked about, saying how it worked in practice.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Well, there's another thing that I like to say a lot, and I don't know if Yoda said this, but...
Oh, the great philosopher, Yoda.
Another great philosopher. Very similar to Bruce Lee in a lot of ways. I would dare say that they modelled some of him, of that character. But there are no failures, only lessons.
There you go.
Yeah.
The experience is what you get when you didn't get what you wanted.
Yeah. So, good luck. I think you'll smash it. And it's great. Go out and hug a tree, people. Yeah. Or plant a tree, even better.
Plant a tree, exactly.
Yeah. Thanks, Matt. Legend.
Thank you.